All right, so effective Bible teaching. Discipleship is important. Leadership is important. Teaching is also very important. Think about how many different times you came under conviction listening to a teaching. Or think about when you first started coming out to Bible studies, just what that was like, and realizing this is something that's relevant, it makes sense. You don't need to have a PhD or some kind of a special secret ability to interpret the Bible, but just hearing it taught was so powerful. You read through Paul's letters to Timothy or Titus. They call these the pastoral epistles, or as I like to call them, the leadership letters. Pastoral epistles is pretty antiquated. That comes from Thomas Aquinas, so we're on the cutting edge of 1050 AD, I mean. The leadership letters are filled chock full with read the scriptures, teach the scriptures, preach the scriptures, teach and preach the scriptures. I mean, go through and do a study. When Paul's writing to a leader, one of the things he should focus on, why is it that he keeps bringing up teaching? It's important for the health of the body of Christ. We really need to remember as we get into teaching, some of us just aren't going to be gifted at this, and that's okay. You have certain giftings that the person next to you doesn't have. That doesn't mean we should boast. It also doesn't mean that we should look down on other people. But God has arranged the body of Christ that it's the collective group of gifts together work to build up his church. And so, that being said, if you're in a time in your home church where you're in a state of what we might call, as Bruce Powers puts it, a state of low morale, where things aren't really going that well, you're trying to get things going, you want to prioritize your gifted or effective teachers. People who are experienced, that know how to do this, you want to put them up on the rotation more. So let's say you broke down your teaching rotation into like A teachers, B teachers, and C teachers. In one of these situations, you might have your A teachers up every third week, something like that, every fourth week. Your B teachers every 6-7 weeks. Your C teachers every 6 months, maybe something like that. When you're getting ready to plant your home church, maybe you give some more people a shot. You give more people a chance to teach. But during times of low morale, you want to have your better teachers up there. Everyone should be willing to put the needs of the group above their own personal desire to teach. Boy, do I believe that. We do it in every other area of ministry. Why is it that we wouldn't do it in this one? Well, I really want to teach. Noted. That's great. But now we have to decide who's going to be on this rotation. It's really exciting when you've been talking to your friend about Christ for weeks and months, even praying for him, and then eventually you get to the point where you're like, dude, you just got to check out this Bible study. And he's like, all right, fine. You know, what time is it? 8 o'clock. All right, I'll be there. And, you know, they finally come out to the Bible study to hear a teaching, and then you have the most boring, awful teacher up there who wanted to teach, and that new person never comes back out again. Oh, is that painful? Contrast that with when you get that new person out to hear a Bible teaching, and it's a really good teaching. It is just like, see, I told you this was awesome. You had to check it out for yourself. And so we got to think about that. I guess that's some strategy to consider. I guess what I'm saying here is you might get into leadership. You might get to the point where you're like, I don't think I'm a gifted teacher. It's like you're willing to do it, but why not pass the ball to somebody else who's better at it? When we think about teaching, the most important thing you can do is to get a proper interpretation of your text. You can't skip this. This is like the first two rules of Fight Club. You know, what's the first rule? Proper interpretation. Second rule, proper interpretation. Oh, how I've hated to admit I've been a week into preparing a teaching only to realize I got the wrong interpretation. That's what it was like when we did our series in 2014 on the book of Revelation. It was like you'd be getting up to teach in 2 days and you realized, I just totally blew the interpretation. Oh man, go back to the cutting board. To get the interpretation correct, you want to go through, I'm not going to share anything revolutionary here. You want to read and reread your passage. Just read it. I like to read it out loud. Just read it and reread it. Read it and reread it. Then you do some study. Then maybe the next day, you go to study it again. Read it out loud. Then maybe the next day, you go to put some more time into your preparation and you read it again. Just reading the passage, you'll start to realize there's certain things in there you didn't see. Try and put the passage into your own words. Like Paul is saying, 1 Corinthians 4, when I come, would you rather have me come with a word of encouragement or with the rod of discipline? I got to figure out how to put that in my own words. What's he saying there? You want to ask good questions of your text. I like to look through. What's that saying? What's that Greek word mean? Let's look at a different translation. Okay, how does NRSV put it? How does NET put it? How does NASB put it? How does NLT put it? Let's get out the Bible dictionary. Let's try and figure out what's that saying. Why does he quote that Old Testament passage? Why would he refer to that? Why has it come up at this point in the context? Why is it that Paul's halfway through a topic and then he goes off on this excursus for 3 chapters? Why is he doing that? Ask good questions. You want to read commentaries discerningly. The old joke about commentators is that you read 5 different commentators and you get 6 different perspectives. It's sometimes less helpful than you might think, reading through commentaries. And some of the most brilliant theologians, I was just reading through one this past week on 1 Corinthians chapter 9. He had completely missed the interpretation. I mean, it was like a brand new believer could have read this chapter better. Pretty discouraging. One of the things I like to do, I like to read commentaries when I'm doing big teachings, but I really like to consult multiple commentaries on difficult passages. So maybe it's that one verse, I don't know how to interpret that. I'll get 4 or 5 different commentaries. But reading through 4 or 5 different commentaries for your passage, good luck. That's a good way to spoil your teaching, as a matter of fact. They call that seminary-itis. That's where guys and women, I guess, come back from seminary, learning about all this critical form, redaction, criticism. And they go up to teach the Bible, and it's just like they totally gut any spirit of the passage because they're too busy talking about the commentators. It's gross. You want to listen to teachings? Listen to MP3s? I like to listen to Den and Gary. They're my 2 favorite teachers. I also like to listen to, a lot of the Calvary Chapel guys. Chuck Smith, Greg Laurie, Pastor Joe Focht, he's out of Pennsylvania. Mike McIntosh, I think his name is, Skip Heitzig. They're Bible believers. And one of the things I like about them is they do expository Bible teaching. They take you through verse by verse by verse. What's this saying? What's that saying? And sometimes you'll be listening to another teacher, and that's where a lot of times the Holy Spirit lights something up to you. I can't tell you, though, how many times I've been listening to another teacher, and then I'm thinking, oh, I would not put it that way. I would have put it this way. And it's basically like you're getting a redo before you teach, is you get to hear their version and make it into your own. Put simply, when we're thinking about proper interpretation, you're following the rules of grammatical, historical, intelligible hermeneutics. And what we're trying to do is expository Bible teaching. We want exposition or exegesis. We want the meaning to come ex. That's the Latin prefix, which means from or out of. Exposition, not imposition. We don't want to take our view and push it into this text to drive home a point. It's not going to do any good. People are going to learn the wrong thing. Maybe you do it to drive home a really cool point, but then other people learn to handle the scriptures that way. Great job. So now you just taught your whole group how to be convicted, but also how to have an improper interpretation. One of my professors told me in hermeneutics, when we're studying how to interpret the Bible, We want to know what we see, not see what we know. When I look at a text, I can know what I'm seeing, not that I'm already knowing what the text is about and putting it into the text. One way of thinking about this is that the Bible was written for us, but it wasn't written to us. We have to jump the bridge of 2,000, 3,000, 3,500 years of time, culture, history, background, to be able to connect with the original audience and what is it that they would be thinking and feeling and reacting to here. And then we're taking that timeless truth and bringing it back to today. Scott Berkin, this is from his book, Confessions of a Public Speaker, which I liked a lot, actually. He's a professional public speaker. That's how he makes his living. He says this on page 57, all good public speaking is based on good private thinking. I like that. For those of you who just have that natural charisma, who are able just to captivate a crowd and get people to laugh and cry and, you know, good for you. But if you don't have any meaningful, substantive thing to say, it's not going to go anywhere. Usually, when you think about your favorite teachers, these are the people that have thought deeply about the text. The kind of person that, John Chrysostom put it back in the 6th century? He said, the gospel is like a pepper. On the outside, it looks cold, and yet when you bite into it, it's fiery hot. These are the kind of people, good Bible teachers, are those that can squeeze out the fiery juices of the word, where they get these insights into the text, which frankly only comes from study, meditation, and prayer. All good public speaking is based on good private thinking. I like that. Well, let's think about the different key components of Bible teaching. You've done your work. You've done your inductive study. You've gone through verse by verse. You know what this passage is saying. Now you're trying to pull all this together. And I'm going to argue. Well, I guess I'm not arguing. I'm always saying arguing, aren't I? I'm going to share. A lot friendlier. I'm going to share some keys to effective Bible teaching. 8 different keys. The first would be memorable main message. After your teaching is over, you have to ask yourself this question. If your audience was to forget everything else that you said, what is the one single thing that you would want them to remember? Akash Karia, this is from his book, How to Deliver a Great TED Talk. He's not a TED speaker. He's a professional speaking expert, Toastmaster, one of those kind of guys, but he had a really good angle. He watched 200 TED Talks. And then he wrote a book on what he observed. That's pretty slick. Anyways, Karia says this on page 16. He says, by the time your audience leaves, they've forgotten 20% of what you've said. The following day, they've forgotten 50% of your message. And within 4 days, they've lost 80% of your message. So for those of us, when we get up to teach where you just can't cut anything, oh, I've got to put in that little nuance of that passage. Oh, I've got to share 8 different extra biblical rabbinic passages that talk about this. Or, oh, I've got to quote the different. They are going to forget most of what you shared. But what is the one thing that they're going to remember? After the teaching, imagine somebody comes in, hears you teach, you finish up your teaching, and after it's over, a latecomer comes through the door and they ask this question to somebody in the audience. What was the teaching about? If they have to sit there and go, well, it was about how Paul was confronted on the Damascus Road by Jesus, but Jesus turned his life around and he turned him from a persecutor into a propagator of the Christian faith. And then he used Ananias to baptize him. And no. What was the teaching about? Tonight's teaching was about how Paul came to Christ. Or tonight's teaching was about how God's grace changes lives. Something that is very concise, terse, to the point. The way Brian Chappell, he's a professor of homiletics, which is this subject we're studying tonight, how to teach. He says it's easier to catch a baseball than a handful of sand, even if the two weigh about the same amount. A lot of teachings you hear are fists full of sand. It's like they're throwing this at somebody, and the person goes to catch it. It's like they catch some of it, but they catch most of it all over their face and hair and head and clothes, and they're kind of itchy thinking about it the rest of the day and night. The way that Gary describes this is he says it's like a fistful of darts versus a sharpened spear. A fistful of darts would be like, I'm going to fight you and I've got a fistful of darts and I just kind of, and a few of them kind of stick, you know, in your chest and stomach and then they fall out and it's just like, you know, ready to fight. Gary describes it as instead of a fistful of darts, you're sharpening your spear throughout your whole teaching. What is the one thing I want to communicate on? And then you're lining up your shot and then conviction right to the gut. You feel the whole weight of the teaching on your chest and you just feel like, oh, a memorable main message. So think about Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. I have a dream. He kept repeating that through that speech over and over and over. It was a memorable main message. Think of Bill Hybels' talk he gave back here in 2005. Walk across the room. He taught a bunch of things in that teaching. I remember him talking about scripture for why the gospel is for real and what the gospel is and listening to the Holy Spirit and so on and so forth. But there's one thing I remember from that teaching. It was that it's just as simple as you need to walk across the room and share your faith with that person. You left that teaching feeling like, I want to go walk across a room somewhere, share Christ with somebody. Rick Warren has a teaching, what on earth am I here for? That's something you could repeat throughout your teaching. What are we here for? And then teach. What are we here for? Teach. And then you could bring in, we're here to love people and love God. Tim Keller has got a title of a sermon and a book, The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. I like that title. Forgetting about self, and that's a freedom. I kind of like that because it's deep. There's some depth to it. The goal for a memorable main message is that you want it to be catchy, but you don't want it to be corny. There's a lot of corny main messages, something that just feels like Sunday school, just feels cheesy. I feel like I'm a fifth grader. I'm having flashbacks to being in grade school, and I just feel patronized. Here's some other examples. You're teaching on spiritual warfare, and the memorable main message could be, the battle is in your mind. That could be the thing you'd want somebody to walk away with. The battle is in your mind. You're teaching on sanctification. Instead of saying, tonight's teaching is on sanctification, you could teach, tonight's teaching is about how God changes lives. And throughout the teaching, you could bring that up. God changes lives. And then at the end, you could make your call. God can change your life. You're teaching on something related to apologetics. Tonight, we're doing a study of apologetics. I don't know if anyone's ever said that ever, but anyways, don't ever do that. Instead, how about this? Faith is not wishful thinking. That's a pretty clever hook. Most people walking into that teaching who aren't a believer are thinking biblical faith is wishful thinking. It's like hoping for something. Or how about this? Biblical faith is not blind faith. Yeah, that could be a good title. Suffering, growing or groaning with God. Could be corny. I don't know. I used it. Are you growing or groaning? I will say I used that back in 2010. And about a year ago, one of the adults that I taught to came up to me and said, I remember that growing or groaning teaching you gave. And I'm like, It's corny, but he remembered it. Tonight we're teaching on evangelism. Or you could say tonight we're teaching on contagious Christianity. Contagious Christianity. Better than infectious Christianity, don't you think? Contagious, that sounds cool. There's alliteration. Yeah, I like that. Okay. So you got your main message, your main point. Secondly, you want to have a strong antithesis. Antithesis. You got your thesis and antithesis. Without strong antithesis, our teaching will sound like Sunday school class. That's what it was like growing up, right? And today we're going to talk about how Jesus washed the disciples' feet. And you should wash the disciples' feet. And it's really good to wash the disciples' feet. And watch how Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Predictable, routine, boring. Look back on the last boring teaching you can think of. One of the most common denominators is that there was no antithesis. Conflict creates tension. It demands for us to pick a side. Like, have you ever been in a restaurant and you're out there with your buddies and, you know, you're sitting around getting drinks and dinner, and in the row right next to you, you hear a married couple and they're going like this. I can't believe that you said that to her. Honey, what do you mean? I can't even look you in the eye right now. I didn't mean anything by it. Well, you said that to her and then she came back and talked to me. Well, yeah, I don't mean, well, you're sleeping on the couch tonight. And you're listening to a conflict. They're not even yelling. They're whispering. What is it about conflict that just draws us in? It's like all of a sudden it's like, I'm sorry, I can't listen. I'm too fascinated by this 80-year-old couple's conflict about their who knows what. But tension does this. And you're kind of thinking to yourself, do I side with the husband or with the wife? I don't know. She sounds kind of nasty. Although he did say that thing to Darlene. I wonder if I side with him. And you feel like I got a pick here. I got a pick. Ways to think about this is as you're going through your passage, you're looking at your passage, you're asking yourself questions like these. What if my audience never adopted this biblical concept? What are some of the things that I would see starting to break down? Let's think, okay, let's pick a passage tonight. Let's do John 13. Memorable main message, sacrificial love. We'll make it boring, okay? Antithesis, John 13. What would happen if the people around me didn't adopt sacrificial love? What would be some of the things I'd start to notice? Well, they'd be having that attitude that what's in it for me, real transactional. There'd be cliques. People would be cloistered off. There'd be a lack of forgiveness. There would be an awkwardness when it came to serving. You'd have some people serving like crazy. You'd have other people not doing it at all. The servants would be getting burned out. The non-servants would be frustrated, not knowing what this Christianity thing is all about. And all of a sudden, you start to take a really simple passage like sacrificial love, and now you start to have an antithesis, something against which you're arguing. Now I got to think, what sort of false beliefs do people have concerning this topic? Let's think, sacrificial love. They must not believe in what Jesus says in John 13, 17, that if you know these things, you're blessed, you're happy, makarios, if you do them. They must think it's okay just to talk about this stuff. They must think it's okay just to be around fellowship rather than actually engaging in koinonia, sharing, koine, to share in common, to share love with each other. They must believe that it's better to be served than to serve. They must think I'm too broken to be able to know how to serve and build other people up. And all of a sudden, we're pulling out the false beliefs, antithesis. And I know not everyone in my group is a sacrificial servant like Jesus, right? Neither am I, right? Everyone's like, amen. And yeah, so I got to start to think, what is it that people are believing about this? Sometimes it's helpful to actually picture someone who has disagreed with this principle, either actively or passively, and start to think, why is it that they lost it over this? How did they disagree? What did they say? How did they act? Did they just flip the proverbial finger Or did they just kind of tacitly just not really into serving this month? And I start to picture that person as though I'm talking to them, and instead I'm talking to 30 people or 300 people or 10 people or whatever. Teaching in a small group can be pretty good to use some of these means, like I like to use the whiteboard where you have two separate columns. You know, law versus grace. Temporal perspective, eternal perspective. Selfish ambition, other-centeredness. Sometimes if you've got a topic where there can be some nuance, you might even do a Venn diagram. You put up two, not antitheses, but two concepts. They could be antithetical, but maybe there's some overlap. It's not a true A or non-A proposition. It's like, how would people respond if they were super spiritual versus if they were too self-focused, out of self-effort, man-centered? Too focused on God's role or too focused on man's role? And then you could do a Venn diagram. So what do you think is the balance in between? What do you think would be a healthy balance? I like to research the opposition, use statistics and quotes. For John 13, I would like to get some clips from Joel Osteen about it's your best life now. Best life now? That's not what Jesus taught. He said your best life is later. Your best life is in heaven, not your best life now. If this is your best life now, you're in for a world of hurt. Because that means the next life is going to be worse than this one. Regardless, I'd like to actually do some research into this. I wonder what certain teachers teach on this. I wonder if I could use statistics. Are there statistics about how friendships fall apart? Are there statistics about why people don't text back in our culture? How many friendships have just ended because people don't text? I mean, I don't know. That's, you're probably thinking that's really stupid. That's where I would go. Like, is there something I could study that would be relevant to this idea of sacrificial love? Maybe a quote, something like that. I like to play devil's advocate. Maybe opening up the teaching like, so Jesus is calling on us. He's calling on you, a respectable person, to get down. Is he seriously saying to get down and wash the poo out of people's toes and toenails? Is that really what he's saying? He's asking you to serve in that kind of a way? What kind of a creepy thing? And so you kind of bring up the devil's advocate approach. You know, devil's advocate, Satan's lawyer. You're basically playing Satan. And then you're coming back and you're refuting that. Is he calling on us to do that? Absolutely he is. And here's why. And you go through and you teach your passage. Read common song lyrics. Oh man, when that Justin Bieber song came out, Love Yourself, I was really hoping the song would be about loving yourself. Instead, it's about his girlfriend who loves herself. Ugh! It's like, that could have been such a great song title to rip apart. But there's an absence of selfish, self-focused lyrics and slogans and movies and TV shows and advertisements. I mean, there's plenty out there. There's a magazine called Self. Self magazine. I'd probably go to the library, copy a couple of those, show them up as, in fact, I did that for a teaching one time. Self magazine. Here's the magazine of our culture. And basically what you're doing is you're trying to get some perspective that's going to connect with people. Okay, so we've been through main message, antithesis, and then in my estimation, the premier way to teach a small group is through discussion. Much better on a home church level. In a small group, discussion, I think, is awesome. Big fan of it. Really encourage people to do it. Some people, you might not be a gifted teacher. You can learn how to do this. You can learn how to do a good discussion. I myself am more gifted in lecture. But I had a buddy that I was a co-leader with. I would get up, and this is back when we would just do lecture. I would just teach for 45, 50 minutes, sometimes an hour, lecture at home church. And then we would do questions and comments, and that was it. I had a buddy who would teach through discussion. He was not as gifted of a lecturer, but by the time that that meeting was over, people were way more pumped, way more excited, way more talkative, way more engaged, and I just started to figure out, this is just better. He's just better. And it's because something about discussion gets people engaged, be very powerful. For discussion questions, I like to encourage people to steer away from personal examples or thesis questions. I share this because, well, let me put it to you like this. Imagine I ask this question, John 13. What would happen if you developed this sacrificial mindset that Jesus is talking about? What would change in your life? You'd become more like Christ. Oh, great answer. Yes. Next. Go ahead. Please. I'm gonna mock you, but it's okay. Go ahead.
You'd be more open to opportunities that can save
up. Yeah, you'd be more open to opportunities. Great answer. Oh, bravo. Oh, that's wonderful.
You'd be more loving.
Oh, you'd be more loving. Oh, you're right. You would be more loving. Doggone it. You would be more loving. Okay, now. Imagine if we asked the opposite. What would happen in your life as a believer if you never adopted this sacrificial mindset? What do you think you'd start to see? Oh, I could think of 100 different answers. Your relationships would start to fall apart. Really? Why? Well, because blah, 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 blah. Intimacy would depreciate. Intimacy is connected to sacrificial love. How? Oh, in this way. Blah, 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 blah. And, okay, let me share another one. In John 13, Jesus says sacrificial love is where it's at. Can somebody share a story from your life about how sacrificial love changed your life? Bad, bad, bad. Because basically you're encouraging people to share about, I'm so different. And honestly, when people ask that question, I don't know what to share. It's not that I don't believe God has changed me in this area. It's just kind of difficult. I get kind of tongue-tied. Like, I don't know what to share. Now, what if you ask the question, how might sacrificial love change someone's life? Instead of a personal question, you make it abstract. You know what's going to end up happening? People are going to share personal stories. How might it happen? Well, the way I've seen it in my life is blah, 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 blah. So, that's just a suggestion, but I think it's tried and true wisdom that it could be helpful. When you're leading discussion, you want to infuse discussion with passion, not passivity. You want to be bringing the excitement. You can't expect the group to bring the excitement. As the discussion leader, you've got to be infusing this to the best of your ability. And so I like to think of it as when somebody's talking, I'm just waiting to interrupt them. So they're talking, yeah. Oh, then I'm jumping in. So it's kind of like we're passing the ball back and forth and we're shooting this around the room and I'm trying to bring the, what do you call it, the chutzpah, the excitement into this teaching. And when people share something good, I'm there to encourage. And somebody shares something that you know, they're like, I disagree with this. I'm like, yeah, I disagree with that too. Oh, yeah, gross. And instead of just flopping out there and just being like, yeah, I'm just here to listen to people share. When you're leading discussion, one of the things you need to do is to write out your questions verbatim. The devil is in the details here. You want to chop from 19 words down to 17 words. And then you want to read that discussion question again. You want to chop from 17 words down to 15 words. You want to read through it again. I want to chop from 15 down to 13 down to, maybe I could get it down to 11, 12 words. And it's going to be very precise. I'm going to spend time calculating, carving out those questions so they look good. And especially for newer teachers, you should email out your questions to some of your co-leaders. Very often, we don't have time to go through the outline of our co-leader. I just don't have time to do that. But I do have time every week to go through their discussion questions. And so kicking these out to your co-leaders and having them look through them and helping you to craft your discussion questions so they look right, they look good, sharp, You could do this. You could get help, and you'd see your discussion increase dramatically. Types of questions to ask. We're going to get back into this in quarter five, but let me give you a little primer. There are heretical questions. So John 13, Jesus says that the goal of life is to love sacrificially. What do you think about this other perspective from Ayn Rand or Friedrich Nietzsche that says that the worst thing in life you could ever do is be altruistic? Heretical question. Cultural question. Looking out at our culture, what is it about this subject that they just don't grasp? So asking a question like, I'm having a hard time. Cultural question for sacrificial love. How is our culture breaking down because they don't understand this? How are friendships breaking down? Marriages, relationships. Why would God questions? Why would God call on us to give sacrificially of our time, our talent, our treasure? Is he a sadist? Does he just want to get more from us? He's just trying to take, take, take. Is that what this is about? You kick that out to the group, and then people can come in and say, no, he's not a sadist. It's actually for our own good. How so? Well, Jesus says, you're blessed if you do this. If he did it, and it was good for him, the joy set before him, Hebrews 12, it's going to be good for us. If you don't do it, you're going to be like Judas at that dinner, John 13. What was the straw that broke the camel's back in Judas's life? Sacrificial love. Once he saw that, oh, we're into foot washing here. I'm out of here. So you could have the group actually make the case for you. Hypothetical questions. What would happen if, or what might happen if somebody didn't adopt sacrificial love? What might happen, hypothetically? Compare and contrast. Sacrificial love versus, I don't know, you could just say selfish love. That's a little bit too easy, though. Sacrificial love versus passive love. How about that? I don't know. What are the people in your group struggling with? Sacrificial love versus clicky love. Clicks. All right, harmonization. This is where you take one passage and you pit it against another, and then you try and get the group to resolve it. So Jesus says that we should serve, but Jesus calls himself the king. So is he the king or is he the servant? I don't know. That's a pretty easy one to answer. But you're trying to get him to harmonize, and through harmonization, that builds learning. A counseling question, how would you help a believer who is really lacking in sacrificial love? Like, what are some of the things you might share with her? Be a good question. What would happen? Question. What would happen in a group if blank? What would happen in a person's life? Blank. What would happen in a friendship? Blank. Or I like to sometimes float out a video. You watch a minute and a half long video of a perspective. Or you read a quote. You got to make sure you print it out so people have it and they can read it, and then they can go, you say something like, so what's your reaction to that? Very open-ended. Very cool for a first-time guest checking out the group. We get to share our reactions here. Thought it stunk, you know? Really? Why? Oh, I just didn't like that at all. And you basically can kick that around the room. What do you think about this perspective? You think there? Sometimes asking the question, do you think there's any truth in it? You think it's all wrong? What's your thoughts on this? Okay. So we've been through main message. We've been through antithesis. We've been through discussion. Now we want to think about burden. Some Bible teachers argue that burden is the most important thing you can have in a teaching. Burden gives you the ability to preach, not just teach. This is where you get the sense from the speaker, they really believe this. And it's an intangible, communicated property. It's something you just pick up, you sense. It's not necessarily that you're flying out of your seat. It could be. Not necessarily. It's not necessarily that you're screaming, though it could be. What is it? It's just burden. It's passion. People need to hear this. To be able to get burden, you need to allow time. Time creates burden. Finish your preparation at least a day early. So the day of your teaching, you can sit there in front of your teaching and ask yourself the question, why do people need to hear this? What's my burden for tonight? Think through the group. Think through people. Why does so-and-so need to hear this? Why does he need to hear this? Why does she need to hear this? Asking questions like this. How has this truth about sacrificial love impacted me? Oh man, I was such an emotional basket case. I'd come out to fellowship and then I would just leave 10 minutes afterward because I was in a bad mood. So unstable. My friends could hardly stand to be around me. And it's because I was selfish. I had not learned this truth. And other people in this group need to hear the same thing. They need to hear what I heard. Why do people in this group need to hear this? What about this material is going to pierce somebody's heart? If I can't come up with an answer to that question, then why did God include this chapter in Scripture? If there is just no point for this, why is it in there? Well, as you get through a list like this, and you start to pray through people, and you start to pray through your own past, you're going to start to discover very quickly that you are developing a burden. You're going to start to be thinking, boy, I hope he's out tonight. Boy, I hope she doesn't skip tonight. She really needs to hear this. Or I hope we have a big night tonight, because our group needs to hear this topic. And you walk in there with a burden, an excitement, a passion to teach. Number five, storytelling. So we've been through main point, antithesis, discussion, burden, and now storytelling. That sounds weird. What's that doing on this list? Very powerful. Storytelling. To be able to teach other people through story. Very biblical. Jesus did it. Paul did it. How many times does Paul give his testimony? Well, in the book of Acts 3, Acts chapter 9, 22 and 26, but then he gives it in Philippians 3, and then he gives it in Galatians 1. I mean, he was just telling his story all the time. Jesus told stories, parables. I like to tell embarrassing stories. I never like to make myself the hero of the story, where you're telling a story and then at the end of the story, yeah, and then I told them the truth at the end of it and they really learned something from me and oh, they were the one who was sinful and errant and wrong, but then, oh, thank God I was there, got to show up. How about the example years ago where we had the woman come out and she was sharing about how her husband was in a conflict with her son. The son had to do work if he did something wrong and so forth. And so the woman speaker was up there and she said, I went and pulled my husband aside and I said, why don't you model the gospel for our son? Why don't you go out there and do his work for him? And I heard that and I was like, that's a cool point, but it would have been better if she had told the story from the other perspective. How about instead of you being the super spiritual, godly one that tells your husband to go out there and do the work, wouldn't it have been cool if she told the story? Now you might be like, well, that'd be lying. Yes, it would. But a lot better than boastfully and pridefully puffing yourself up in front of an audience. Well, that's lying. Well, I guess Paul lied in 2 Corinthians 12. I once knew a man who was taken up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I'm not sure. He saw inexpressible. Who's he talking about there? He's talking about himself. But he doesn't want to speak in the first person. Why? Because it'd be too prideful to do so. So how about instead of telling these stories where you're the hero, you tell the story from the perspective that you're the villain. And frankly, if you think long enough, you don't have to make up a story where you looked embarrassing, foolish, and sinful. You can just tell the story of when you were embarrassing, foolish, and sinful. Use vicarious teaching. This is where you're sharing a story about somebody who really got this. You're teaching on materialism, and you tell the story about My friend, who is a lawyer in fellowship, and his law firm was pressuring him to give up his priorities to follow Christ. They said, what are your priorities? And he said, well, first is God, second is family, and third is fellowship, and then maybe fourth or fifth is this law firm. And the law firm said to him, well, we want number two on that list, and frankly, maybe even number one. He walked away. He quit his job. Got a new job. What did I just do? I gave you some vicarious teaching. You never went to law school. You never had to turn down six figures at a very affluent law firm. But you got to hear his story, and it's vicarious teaching. You get to hear about how somebody else did it. And the same is true for failures. You can tell the story about failures. This is where what Jesus did. He was telling the parable about the rich man. Luke 14. The story about the man who was going out to war, but he only brought half the soldiers necessary, and he got decimated. He didn't count the cost. He's building a house. He only had half the money to pay for the house. Guess what happened? They didn't build the house, and the whole neighborhood laughed at him. That's vicarious teaching. That's where he's telling a story about how somebody failed, and don't do that, is what Jesus is saying. Good storytelling is kind of like good fiction, good writing. You want to create mental movies, is what fiction authors will say. Good storytelling engages the five senses. So people who are listening, they get to see the scene. They hear the sounds. They feel the emotions. You're very specific. This is what we call showing rather than telling. Instead of telling people what happened, you show them through the art of story. So let me give you an example. I went to the store today, and this guy was really angry at me, and he cut in front of me in line, and then he cussed me out. And then I had to go get the manager. Boring thought verbs. He did this. I thought this. I thought that. How about this one? So I walked into Giant Eagle today, and there was a guy behind me that kept bumping me with his cart until eventually I was like irritated and turned around. And I saw him. He had a snake tattoo crawling out from underneath his shirt. He was so blustered. His face was red, and I was seeing veins popping out of his neck. He was just on fire. It looked like his head was like a turnip. It was going to explode. And I could hear this whistling in his teeth. It was like this weird... And as I was talking to him, and then I just kind of turned away, but I could still feel the breath on the back of my neck. It's like if I just turned around, I was going to be looking face to face with Satan. And what did I do? I'm telling you the scene. You're hearing the sounds. You're feeling the emotions. It's show rather than tell. Here's an example from author Chuck Palahniuk. He's the author of Fight Club, one of the filthiest authors on the block. I don't know if you've ever read Palahniuk's work. Very good fiction writer, though. He gives this tip. He says, instead of saying, Adam knew Gwen liked him. That's a thought verb. Adam knew. He knew that. He says, you can say this. Between classes, Gwen had always leaned on his locker when he'd go to open it. She'd roll her eyes and shove off with one foot, leaving a black heel mark on the painted metal, but she also left the smell of her perfume. The combination lock would still be warm from her butt, and the next break, Gwen would be leaned there again. Adam knew Gwen liked him. Not as good as that second one, is it? The guy behind me in the thing was really angry. The guy behind me, his face looked like he was going to explode. So mental movies. Avoid endings that are predictable. That's what makes for a good story. We're not making things up. It's got to be a real story, but you can think about how you're going to share it and what to share. That story I was sharing about the family that was in conflict, and the husband went out and served the son to communicate the gospel to him. That's a twist ending. You don't expect that. Yeah. Number six, So we've been through main point, antithesis, discussion, burden, storytelling, and then finally, number 6, analogies. Good analogies. These are sometimes the only thing you remember for a teaching. You walk out of a teaching, you vaguely remember what passage it was, you vaguely remember this, but you remember that one analogy. Sometimes it's very visceral. I remember sitting as a brand new believer. This is going back years, years and years and years. I remember hearing a Bible study on the new identity. And the reason that we live for Christ is because that's who we are. It's not that we couldn't go live for sin. It's just that we would never want to. And I remember in the Bible teaching, the teacher was like, yeah, it reminds me of defecating in my pants. Being like, does he know what the word defecate means? He just used that in the, what? Why did he use that? And he's like, yeah, like there was a certain point in my life where I just really enjoyed defecating in my pants. And then there was a while where it's like, I had a hard time not defecating in my pants. Now I'm older. I still could defecate. I'm free to defecate my pants all I want. I just don't really want to. That's just not who I am anymore. That's the only thing I remember from that teaching. I don't even know what book it was on. I just remember being like, I'm going to use that someday. Good analogies. The way to build on these, if you read good authors, C.S. Lewis, very good. Watchman Nee, very good. Tim Keller, very good. Especially in his teaching. You'll hear some of his teachings. And a lot of it's reformed, and so he's going to have a different perspective on things, but there's going to be certain times where he connects with an illustration that you're like, wow, that's really good. For me and my family, we like to steal illustrations. I will shamelessly steal other people's stuff, especially if it's good. Or maybe I'll slightly alter it. You know, maybe it's the defecating in my pants illustration. Maybe I'll change that to urinating in my pants. Same thing. Take the illustration. People, I remember recently I was like, I got this illustration for your teaching and shared it. And the girl teacher was like, well, I can't use that. Why not? That's your illustration. So where do you think I get my stuff from? I steal ruthlessly from other people. I don't plagiarize. Plagiarism is bad, but stealing illustrations. Oh yeah. I don't feel like I have to add a verbal footnote. Every time I steal an illustration, we'd be there all night. Analogies, get help. Get help. You know, you're going to your prep and you're looking at this thing and you're like, man, this is really complicated. How God in the Old Testament worked through certain ceremonial laws, and now in the New Testament, those have been fulfilled in Christ. I need an illustration to capture that. What's it going to be? And you come up with something kind of wimpy, lousy, and you take it to your friend and you're like, this is the illustration I have. Can you help me? And then brainstorm together until you come up with a good illustration. Less is more when it comes to illustrations. If your illustration takes you 10 minutes to give, it would be easier just to explain the concept at that point. Illustrations should be short. I'm thinking no more than a minute. Get to the point. Sometimes you can just make these really short, like, just like you wouldn't feel the need to defecate in your pants when you're 25 years old, so too, when you grow with Christ, you don't feel like you need to go out and sin. It can be very quick. Keeping a record or a journal, sometimes when I'm sitting under a Bible teacher, they'll throw something out and I'll go, ooh, yeah, that is tasty. I'm going to steal that for later. Remember sitting in a home, a lot of my teaching illustrations for CT come from sitting under home church teaching. Somebody makes a good point, and I go, yeah, I'm going to write that down. Illustrations, analogies, keep them simple, keep them short. A lot of times these can just be thrown in. You're talking about persecutors and how they're trying to go after God's people, and you know, from God's perspective, these persecutors must look no more intimidating than an army full of fruit flies. That's a quick 5-second analogy that would punch right to the gut, make the point. Number seven, humor. So we've been through main message, antithesis, discussion, burden, storytelling, analogies, humor. Number seven. One more to go. Elton Trueblood, who is a Quaker theologian, a Quaker, in his book, The Humor of Christ, before I read this, you're like, oh, what's this going to be about? Is this like a two-page book? He says this. He says, any alleged Christianity which fails to express itself in humor at some point is clearly spurious, false. Kind of funny coming from a Quaker theologian. See the point he's making? The Bible is funny. It is a funny book. I know this shouldn't be funny. Maybe it I don't know. That's the thing, is Jesus will make a joke and I'm like, should I laugh? I don't know if I should or not. But Matthew chapter 7 always cracks me up. Why do you go to your brother to get the speck out of his eye when you have a log sticking out of your eye? That is comedy, people. It's just like there's a log and you're walking around and you're like, hey, you got a speck in your eye. I can't talk to you. You have a log in your eye. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Just think about that for a second. Like a camel like working his way into like a little needle's eye. One girl taught that and she said, unless they have like a really big blender, that's not going to work. Gross. Humor. Bible's a funny book. How many times have you guys been sitting under Scott Risley teach and he's got you so into the narrative that he just clicks to the next slide and just from reading the passage makes you laugh? It happens all the time. Well, for the best humor, for what we're doing and trying to accomplish, I mean, if you're giving a best man speech at a wedding, if you're, you know, talking at work or something, whatever, but we're talking about Bible teaching here. Best way to work in humor is into your illustrations or your stories. Think about it like this. When you have an illustration or a story, it's not that you replace it with humor. It's that you sprinkle a little bit of humor on. So going from a good illustration to a good illustration that's funny. That's like a two for one. So you could say total depravity is like having a glass full of water and then sprinkling just one drop of poison into it. That's a pretty good illustration. Let's make it funny. Total depravity is like having a pool and squeezing one poop into that pool. It would communicate the same point, but it'd be funny. The second part's funnier than the first. The same thing is true here. You're telling a story, and as you're telling the story, you're throwing in humor and so forth. Drawing humor from your passage. Sometimes you'll be in your passage and you start to notice something in there that you're like, that could be funny. The reaction. That's a really good sign that you got people into the passage if they're laughing at the passage. It means they're following the characters, the tension, and so forth. For good humor, like you'll watch Louis C.K. or I don't know who you watch. Oh, I guess he's gone now. But Patton Oswalt, funny comedian, George Carlin. All my favorite comedians are atheistic comedians for some reason. But I don't know who you watch. And you watch them speak and you're like, man, they're just funny. They're just really funny. There's a whole science behind humor that people have studied. Certain words are funnier than others. A lot of humor has to do with the setup and then breaking expectations. It's you're building up to a point and then you're expecting this and you get this. Why is it that when you're walking down the street and just a guy in a suit and a business coat and a briefcase is walking down the street, when he slips and falls and lands on his face, that is just the funniest freaking thing I've ever seen. Why is that? It's because he's very professional and very serious, and the expectation is he's just going to walk to work and go to work and 8 hours later go home to his boring life, and you know. But then you see him walk down the street and fall on his face. Why is that so funny? Because you're not expecting it. That's why. Or it could just be because we're insanely depraved and we like to watch people get hurt. Okay, so a setup and a breaking of expectation. Here's one. In Joshua 5, God called the soldiers to be circumcised. So you can imagine this scene. Joshua yelling, you guys got your swords? Yeah. You guys got your shields? Yeah. You guys still got your foreskins? You see how there's an expectation, like sword, shields, foreskins, and then ending with foreskins is just funny. This is foreskins. Foreskins is a funny word. Make fun of yourself in your teaching. This is good because you're not going to offend anybody. The other thing is somebody coming into a Bible study, looking at you, the Bible teacher, they're going to be feeling millions of light years away from you. And if you start to kind of make fun of yourself throughout the teaching, they're going to discover, okay, I like this person. They're normal. They're like me. Here's an example. When I was younger, I was skinny, pale, and had big bug eyes. I basically looked like I was on a perpetual mission to get the ring back from Frodo. Hilarious. Exaggerate or embellish. Exaggerate or embellish for humor. You're telling a story and you exaggerate someone's reaction. So for example, they had this look on their face like they were trying to pass a kidney stone or something. It's like you're just telling a story, but adding that part about passing a kidney stone is like, well, clearly he didn't look like that, but it's exaggerating for the effect of humor. After my first teaching, it was so bad, I went upstairs and curled up in a fetal position and I cried for hours. Did you really do that? No, it's a joke. It's exaggerating and embellishing for the sake of humor. Exaggerating people's weaknesses or abilities. So you're telling a story about something and, you know, you're talking about being in junior high and you're like, I started to lift weights when I was 13 and I was so strong I could curl those green plastic weights 6 or 7 times in a row without taking a break. It'd be funny if it was in a teaching. Optimism or pessimism? I was at a wedding recently when I told people I teach the Bible for a living. They said, why did I get stuck at your table? I was really looking forward to a great night out. Now I'm stuck with you. Now, do you think anybody would ever say that? No, but it's you're exaggerating, you're embellishing, and you're kind of winking at your group at the same time. You're communicating. It's a joke, you know, but it's basically exaggerating for the sake of effect. Making cultural allusions. Why is this so funny? I don't know, but Patton Oswalt or who's the other guy? John Mulaney. I like him a lot too. He'll just say like a name everyone knows and the audience will crack up. You're just like, that's not funny. He's just naming somebody from pop culture. Judge Judy. Here's a picture of Judge Judy. This is the first picture in recorded history of her smiling. Seriously, it's easier to get a picture of Sasquatch. I like this one because it has the word Sasquatch in it. Sasquatch. I just find that word funny. The hatred between the Jews and the Gentiles was awful. It was almost as bad as Mac and PC users today. Following the law is impossible. It'd be easier to fit 40 people into a smart car. People are like, smart car, I know what that is. That's funny. Ah, I know what a smart car is. Ah, 40 people? Ah. My friend looked so depressed, he looked like he was just coming from a Cleveland Browns game. Everyone's like, oh, Cleveland Browns, bad, depressing, funny. What is that? It's just like Judge Judy, smart cars, PC. For some reason, when you make an analogy with pop culture, people think it's funny. I don't know why. I'm going to keep doing it until they stop laughing. Create funny comparisons. This guy was so type A, he made Arnold Schwarzenegger seem like Michael Cera. Michael Cera. The guy was so boring to listen to. He sounded like Ben Stein on NyQuil. This guy looks so scary. He reminded me of Gary Busey. He does those Fire Stick commercials. What is it? What am I talking about? They like do up his hair and everything. I mean, there's like Gary Busey's just embraced that he's scary. It's awesome. Anyways. Sometimes if I'm about to teach, I'll actually type in most hated celebrities. And you'll get like, you know, Nicki Minaj and Justin Bieber and then you just get like a list. And you're like, okay, these are fair game. You don't want to pick people that like if you're like Bon Iver or like, you know, like some like indie band that someone's like, oh, that hurts when you said that. My favorite band. So anyways, that's kind of the science of it. Does that make sense? Yeah, work it into illustrations or stories. You set up and then you break expectations. Making fun of yourself is always safe. Exaggerating, embellishing, as long as they know you're not lying, you're kind of winking, like, didn't really happen like that, but whatever. Cultural allusions, funny comparisons, stuff like that. All right. Warning regarding humor. Don't offend your listeners at a Bible study for the sake of being funny. That would be a very, very foolish thing to do. You're going to get a cheap laugh, and yet somebody there is going to go home offended by that. Don't let humor lighten the Holy Spirit's conviction. Sometimes you're bringing down this point, and it's landing right on the person's chest, and it's like, as the teacher, you just have to let the word do its work. And sometimes insecure teachers, they make a really good point, and it lands, and then they throw in a cheap joke to lighten it because they feel uncomfortable. Don't ever let humor get in the way of the Holy Spirit's conviction. And finally, don't allow humor to become a narcissistic endeavor to glorify self. We've seen some people get up to teach before. I mean, it was like 30 minutes of comedy hour. Some of the funniest stuff you've ever seen. I mean, back to back to back to back, and you get to the end of it and you're just like, I would never want to hear them teach ever again. They had nothing to say. It was just, look how funny I am. Here's the point of humor. The goal of humor is for people to pay attention, not for you to get attention. That's what humor is supposed to be. It's your audience is dead, they're tired, and if you can get people to laugh and pay attention, that draws them back in. Okay, finally, number 8, gospel presentation, a teaching essential. Think about this. Think about this. We've got a non-Christian guest who has agreed to come check out a Bible study, and they're sitting there for 45 minutes listening. They're here to explore what the Bible has to say. We've got an opportunity here. Why miss it? Why would you skip this? They're sitting right in front of you. They're not talking. They're lit. They want to hear what you have to say. You know, we go to school, we go to work, we go to everyone else, and we're listening to what other people have to say, and that's fair, that's fine. But now they've come to hear the Bible taught, and it's your turn to share about God. Let's make the most of these opportunities. Plan beforehand. How am I going to explain this? What am I going to say? How am I going to share it? Am I going to use an illustration? The judge and his son, the cashing the check illustration, the Facebook stalking illustration. You've heard all these, right? From last quarter? Yeah. Am I going to use an illustration? Am I going to use a verse? If so, which one? John 1:12? Well, we used that for the last 4 weeks at our group. Maybe I should pick a different passage. Let's give them the other passage rather than John 1:12 every time. Instead of telling people that you want to see them come to Christ, a good rule of thumb is to show people. This is a personal pet peeve of mine. When people are giving the gospel and they say, I plead with you, come to Christ tonight. I plead with you. Instead of saying, I plead with you, why not just plead with them? Do you recognize the difference I'm drawing? John 1:12. Let me read this. So to all who received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. If you're here tonight and you've never made that decision to invite Christ in your life, I plead with you to do that. Versus John 1:12, to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. If you are here tonight and you have never made that decision to open up your heart to the love of Christ, what would hold you back from doing that right now? Do that here with us tonight. Don't miss this opportunity. I mean, that's pleading. You don't sit there with your friend and say, hey, I plead with you. Don't go back to heroin. You say, dude, you're ruining your life. pleading with them. Here's Charles Spurgeon, Charles Haddon Spurgeon from The Soul Winner. He says, "Preach as you would plead if you were standing before a judge and begging for the life of a friend, or as if you were appealing to the Queen herself on behalf of someone very dear to you. Use such a tone in pleading with sinners as you would as if a gallows were erected in this room and you were to be hanged on it unless you could persuade the person in authority to release you." This is the sort of earnestness you need in pleading with men as ambassadors for God. That imagery that you're talking to the judge and they're going to sentence this person to jail and you're there pleading with that judge, "Please don't do this. Please let them go." That is pleading. Now, that being said, this doesn't have to be loud. This doesn't have to be screaming or anything like that. In fact, in a small group of 30 people, I would prefer if it wasn't loud. It would feel pretty uncomfortable. I remember listening to a home church teacher. Oh, it was his first time to teach, and he was ramping up, and he was so excited, and his words were so close together. He was talking a mile a minute. And he got up to the end of this thing and he's, it just sounded like somebody's like revving up an engine, you know. He's like, after the teaching was over, I rarely give negative feedback to a first time teacher. I'm usually like, "Man, that was good and that was good. And do that again." This guy though, he came up to me and he's like, "So how do you think I did?" And I was like, that would have been really good if you were teaching to a coliseum of 10,000 people. But there was a 30-person room, and you were screaming. He never taught again, actually. I'm kidding, he did. I'm totally kidding. Don't let humor avoid conviction. It doesn't have to be some kind of loud theatrical thing. It's just a plea from the heart of the teacher to the guest that you come to Christ here tonight. So, well, that's all I had for that section, at least.